The following program was pre-recorded and produced by volunteer programmers at KPFT Pacifica Radio in Houston, Texas, to air on Friday, October 12th, also known as Columbus Day. We've invited a noted scholar who has published several works on the voyages and accomplishments of Christopher Columbus. He'll be sharing some of this history with us, as well as some of his own. Stay tuned for a conversation with Ward Churchill.
Madness and chasing the mundane. Between the scarring of dreams, racing against daytime's nightmares, trying to put that bad road behind. Here it is, already tomorrow afternoon, while the clock claims it's still yesterday. Too many games played in too many heads. So many questions, but nothing gets said.
Here it is, already tomorrow afternoon, while the clock claims it's still yesterday. Too many games played in too many heads. So many questions, but nothing gets said.
Fear teaches denial how not to think. Distorting feelings as a way not to feel. The need to believe shoots up its fix. Scoring with promises when the lie doesn't work. With more tears in our eyes than stars. Civilized cruelty's disguise of rationalization. Elitist class. Racist, sexist rage, chains of freedom, and a crack in the Liberty Bell.
Here it is, already tomorrow afternoon, while the clock rings, it's still yesterday. Too many games played in too many heads, so many questions, but nothing gets said.
Quote, without reservations, I support Churchill's right to free speech and academic freedom and regard the attack on him as scurrilous and by now craven cowardice as well. The state authorities and other critics pretend that the issue is suddenly his academic credentials and ethnic origins. That's a real disgrace. Unquote. Noam Chomsky.
Welcome to a Pacifica Houston informational special report. Killing the Indian to save the man. The firing of Ward Churchill. This is Edwin Mercado with my co-host, Stacy Davis.
Today, we will be speaking with Ward Churchill, examining his explanation of his firing as tenured professor of the University of Colorado Boulder on July 24, 2007. Ward Churchill has written many books focusing on Native American history, indigenous human rights, globalization, neoliberalism, COINTELPRO, and genocide.
So stay tuned to Killing the Indian to Save the Man, the firing of Ward Churchill.
Music, commentary, and our interview.
Wounds without scars, scars without wounds, darkening the heart in an isolation of time. In the shadows, alone is the hunter. Love without love, looks for love to survive. Madness in the same part of insane. Could it be that just to survive or exist, when viewed through the prism of light, can be considered a lower form of life?
Already tomorrow afternoon, while the clock claims it's still yesterday. Too many games played in too many heads. So many questions, but nothing gets said. But nothing gets said. But nothing gets said. Oh!
Here is Gloria Rubach on the line with Ward Churchill, joined by Carla Cooper and Randall Callinan in the studio.
I want to thank you very much on behalf of KPFT for joining us today and doing this
Pleasure.
This show, which I understand is going to be aired on Columbus Day, October 12th. And I guess the place to begin is with you and what has happened to you at the University in Colorado. This started after 9/11. What did you do after 9/11 that became so controversial?
Well, on 9/11, I wrote a gut response piece to what I had witnessed in real time on TV and to the framing on all three of the major cable news networks that this was a senseless act. People on the U.S. side, at least, were, by definition, innocent. And that was a context in which they were talking about maybe 17,000, 18,000 people having been in the World Trade Center. They had no clue who was there or who had done it or anything else, but it was automatically senseless, which seemed rather suspect. There would be a purpose for people to do that which was done on September 11th. You could agree or disagree with the purpose, no doubt, but it wasn't senseless. Cable feeds were saying the same thing. It was a senseless act, and all these innocent people had died. Innocent by definition, despite the fact they had no idea who they were, which seemed a little strange as well. And so I set myself, at the request of electronic journal, Dark Knight Field Notes, that they needed an immediate response, kind of off the top, as to what this was about, tried to envision who might have done it and why. Turned out I was right on two of the three counts. I didn't know who had done it. I'd never, at that point, even heard of Al-Qaeda, but it seemed to me rather reasonable to suspect that that might be in response to a 500,000 dead Iraqi children that Madeleine Albright had anointed as being worth the price to send a message of freedom to their government that what we say goes. It also occurred to me that it might be in response to Palestinian kids getting shot in the head for the crime of throwing a rock during the Intifada in protest of now three consecutive generations of their people being displaced from their land and compelled to either live in condition of diaspora as exiles in other countries or in refugee camps under military occupation that shows no signs of abating, a situation that would not be possible without massive support and continuous support from the United States. That was two of the three things that were stated as being the predicating motives by Al-Qaeda when they made their statement a week later. I didn't get the part about U.S. troops being in Mecca, but it's blatantly obvious that there would be motive tied into this and that these might be among the motives. It didn't require any great intellectual exercise to do that. And you have twin symbols, that being U.S. corporate reach on a planetary basis and the globalization of economy, which results in wholesale immiseration of third world children, for example, being chained to machines and sweatshops in Malaysia and the Marshall Islands and here and there. And on the other hand, the Pentagon, which is a symbol of corresponding military might to ensure the, quote, stability that's necessary for that kind of corporate reach to occur. And so you got a systemic situation by the United States that's called progress that results in all manner of unacceptable, indefensible outcomes among mostly people of color the world over. And the people who are engaged in that, knowingly engaged, because the cost and consequence of global reach by the United States, how the United States does business around the world, is not exactly mysterious. And so you got people making choices for purposes of profit maximization, increase of stock price, payment of dividends to shareholders, and commission on the part of the brokers and so on that inhabited the World Trade Center, for example. Their choice is to engage in business enterprise in a manner which results in this massive immiseration and carnage the world over. They do that as a matter of choice for personal gain. That is the moral equivalent to me of Eichmann, Adolf Eichmann, the logistician of the Holocaust, who engaged in a technical exercise in order to fulfill policy of what was considered progress in that context, not directly killing people, but making the killing, which was the collateral effect of what he did, more efficient. that if there is a better way, or any way at all, to bring consequence or even a non-detachment from reality of the effects of what they're doing upon these little Eichmanns in the towers, I'd like to hear what it is. Someone tell me. So it was the little Eichmann thing that everyone locked in on. I made a strategic miscalculation, I think, in the framing at that time, which was to believe that your average American might even know who Adolf Eichmann actually was and what it was that he did that made him a sort of a symbol of evil. And the responses that I got once this became public knowledge, which was not really until 3 years later, it was published, but no one paid any attention to it until ACTA and Bill O'Reilly and so on decided to make a political point of it. The responses that I got in the main were talking about me making comparison between the stockbrokers and the international financiers and so forth to the guy who was the commandant of Auschwitz. I even had one argue with me in the emails that I was wrong, that at the end of the war, when the commandant of Auschwitz fled, Eichmann stepped in and finished the job. Well, he was never commandant of Auschwitz, and he never killed anyone directly. He was not convicted of it, and in fact, was not really accused of it, even by the Israelis. So it's a complete detachment from reality and another respect there. And the response, the visceral response that attended my case came from that profound misunderstanding of historical reality.
You have just referred to your case. Can you tell us what your job was at the time of 9/11 and then what has happened since then?
Yeah. I was a professor of ethnic studies with a focus on American Indian studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and since then I've been fired for saying that, although they've come up with a set of pretexts that I engaged in academic misconduct as a cover for that. But I was fired essentially for having offended, well, as it was put on a blog in Denver, Ward Churchill was fired for calling little Eichmanns little Eichmanns.
By the little Goebbels.
Little Goebbels in there, too, but that's not the people who were targeted. I mean, no one really targeted Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity, and that's the Goebbels end of things, but that wasn't the focus of the attack.
But you're not the only person in the United States who has looked at 9/11 and looked at U.S. foreign policy, which earlier you called progressive. Some people would call imperialist. But
well, I was making that framing in their own terms. They call this progress.
Exactly.
I call it genocide, but that's difference in perception.
Absolutely. The immediate response of the university was what?
Well, the immediate response of the university, once this became the focus of O'Reilly and the Denver media and so on, O'Reilly devoted segments on 41 consecutive nights, by my count, 460 major newspaper articles come out in the three papers in the Denver metro area in barely 60 days. I mean, you're talking saturation negativity. In the middle of that frenzy, the acting chancellor of the University of Colorado simply denounced what I had said on its face as repugnant and reviled by the entire university community, and convened an ad hoc investigation of, quote, everything I had ever written and everything I had ever said, at least insofar as it had been recorded so that they could have access to it, in an open-ended fashion. So I don't know whether they were looking at my high school term papers or what. They certainly went back to before I was a professor, pure and simple, to see if I'd crossed some magical line. That's what he said, see if he's crossed the line on other occasions. I don't know what this line is that I supposedly crossed in terms of my speech or my thought, but I do understand there's constraints on free speech in the United States. These would constitute criminal acts, arguably sedition or treason or something along that line. Criminal conduct, as I understand it, is purview of entities like the FBI, not an ad hoc committee convened by the acting chancellor of a university. That's what they said they were doing to assuage the public that was outraged by what I had said. And they worked that around to, well, we've come up with these allegations of plagiarism and misrepresentation of sources and falsification, what they call it, fabrication of historical events, none of which turned out to be true. But they nonetheless made a case on it so they could make an argument that they had effected a firing after due process on grounds
Mr. Churchill, this is Randall Callinan, civil rights lawyer and free speech lawyer. And I had a question. In the ensuing litigation and all your discovery and elsewhere, have you found any monetary interests that were putting pressure on the university to fire you?
Absolutely.
And who would those be?
Well, it's usually framed in terms of alumni. What you have is a coordinating entity, ACTA. That's, what is it, Association Concerned Alumni and Trustees, Trustees and Alumni, or something, Lynn Cheney's organization, which was co-founded by the now president of my university, Hank Brown, a Republican senator. Hank Brown himself, after having left the Senate, became president and CEO of something called the Daniels Fund, which is a right-wing slush fund here in Colorado, which gives to, from their point of view, ideologically acceptable innovations in the academy. Now, he announced about 60 days into the grand investigation of me and my work that as CEO of the Daniels Fund, he was withholding $400,000 that was earmarked for the University of Colorado, and he would continue to withhold it until the, quote, controversy was resolved. He was then hired as the president and assumed that their cash flow has improved immensely. First thing he did after I was fired was send out a letter to contributors, both alumni and foundations and so forth, that the problem was resolved and they should feel free to now contribute to the University of Colorado.
Now, Mr. Churchill, who exactly did you sue? Where are you in the litigation, and is there a trial date yet set?
There's not a trial date yet. Who I've sued is the regents of the University of Colorado, named no one else, and the suit was filed the morning after my firing, the 24th of July, filed in state court rather than federal court. Not particularly confident of the federal judiciary after 20 years of Republican appointments initiated by Reagan. These guys write their opinions before they get to court, in my experience, and I've witnessed that. So we're going to put it before the vaunted Colorado taxpayers. I say vaunted because they're always talking about the 6 cents on every dollar that is contributed to the university by the taxpayers of Colorado. We're going to put the issues to them and see what a jury of my peers actually determines in a not-so-rigged setting. Trial date I expect to be a year out. That's the usual timetable, late summer, early fall.
The essay that you wrote was called On the Justice of...
Pushback, originally.
Okay.
The subtitle was On the Justice of Roosting Chickens, and I analogized to what Malcolm X had said,
right,
worried about the assassination of John Kennedy, which was, near as he could tell, it was simply a case of chickens coming home to roost. You know, what Kennedy was responsible for having done out in the world to come back and paid a visit to him rather personally. Had framed two ways, one based on the Malcolm statement, and I was trying to envision who those chickens might be. I ran it really all the way back through history to a game of kickball that was played with the heads of Wappinger Indians at more or less the same spot where the foundations of the World Trade Center stood. That was in what was called New Amsterdam at the time. The Indians in question were the Indians who actually owned Manhattan Island, and the real estate issue, question and title, was resolved by exterminating those Indians. A little Dutch expedition that did that brought the heads back to prove it. Some of the heads were used for kickball. That was part of the celebration. So you've got a sort of a continuous, egregious behavior associated with that very spot. So I had traced up history and said, you know, we got an awful lot of chickens coming home to roost here. And, you know, someone's sending you a message, listen to it. Because if you actually had parity of payback on this stuff, it would be something you didn't even want to think about. And that was, to me, the message of that day. The United States has assigned itself a position of entitlement to impunity, no consequence in kind for what it does in the world, and eventually, its assumptions notwithstanding, somebody pushed back the same way the United States pushes out there in the world. Upshot of that was, if you don't like that, and there's no reason to expect anybody would like it, enjoy the experience on the U.S. side of things, okay, and you want to be free from more of it, stop doing it to other people. Best national security policy you could have be stop killing other people's babies.
You know, you've mentioned two things. One is the question of the Native Americans who owned or occupied Manhattan Island at the time, and that makes, to me, a comparison comes to mind when you say, when you were talking about being paid back or reparations. to the struggle that the African American community is now waging for reparations. Do you see a connection?
Sure, and mentioned it in the piece. I mean, the World Trade Center sits off the end of what's referred to as Wall Street. Wall Street takes its name from the wall of the enclosure of the slave market in New York. That's where the name comes from. So when you are cognizant of that, when you make that connection, then you're talking about the Middle Passage and the costs and consequences of the Atlantic slave trade and the impact of that on the societies of Africa, which was, again, genocidal. They always say, well, it wasn't really genocide because they weren't killing. Genocide is not a synonym for killing, okay? It's any policy undertaken that brings about or is intended to bring about the dissolution and disappearance of a targeted human group in whole or in part. Well, they were clearly targeting the societies of the west coast of Africa for the acquisition of the commodity, which was black flesh as chattel slaves.
Exactly.
In the sense of genocide, it doesn't matter whether they died in the Middle Passage or died once they got here or died at all. They were just as good as dead for purposes of the societies from which they were taken because they never came back. So the impact on those societies was just the same as if you'd had a mass extermination occur.
The city of Denver in Colorado is known for one of the largest activities around Columbus Day in the country. And what you're talking about, I'm quite taken aback. I had no idea that's where the name Wall Street came from. But when Columbus came to the Caribbean and he began to use the indigenous people there as slaves, when they eventually were being killed, either because they were being worked to death or they were dying from European diseases, the slave trade began, and then Africans were imported from West Africa. Can you tell us about Columbus Day activities and how this relates to Columbus and the struggle today?
Well, yeah. What most people hear about Columbus is 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, that little jingle you hear in grade school. And it wasn't a matter of discovery. I mean, the land was obviously already discovered. It was inhabited. He thought he found the Garden of Eden somewhere off the coast of Japan. He was looking for Japan, not India. There was no place called India. He called the people Indios. That's two words in either Italian or Spanish, or Portuguese for that matter. I mean, who he was in that regard is not known. There's no clear indication that he was of Italian descent. But in any of the three languages at issue, because he had sailed earlier for the Portuguese crown under the flag of Portugal, and he was sailing under the Spanish flag at the time he made the fabled voyage to Espanola, washing up at a beach half a world away from where he thought he was and getting known as a great navigator as a result. Okay. He referred to the people as Indios, the two words, which means not any kind of reference to India. There's no map from that period which has a place called India. It's referred to as Hindustan when it's reflected at all. Indios means next to God. People next to God's what he thought he had found. The remaining population of the Garden of Eden. He came back on two more voyages. There were three Columbian voyages. In the second voyage, he came back not as a seaman or an explorer or a supposed discoverer, but as admiral of the ocean sea and as viceroy of everything he'd encountered and everything he would encounter. I mean, it had this sort of anticipatory clause in his contract, if you will. It said, if you find the mainland of the area you've discovered, you're going to be viceroy of that, too. Well, he never did, great sailor that he was. But what you were talking about comes out of his earlier experience in his station in Espanola, as he called it, which is present-day Dominican Republic in Haiti. He was to set up a governing regime, and he brought hidalgos, that is, nobility that were landless in Spain, to establish themselves in this new world that he had found. Now, Columbus was a slave trader. He had been involved in the Portuguese slave trade. That's where he got the maps, and that's where he got the experience to sail the boats, mission himself out to Spain to try to circumvent what was referred to as the Islamic barrier. Okay, Islam stood between Europe on the one hand, which was trying to get into the game of economic growth, enrichment, and the Orient from which the commodities would come that would lead to that. So they were trying to circumnavigate Africa when the slave trade was inaugurated around 1450. Now, he was a participant in that, and he came up with the idea, since they were unable to circumnavigate Africa at the time, they never made it around Africa prior to 1492. He had this notion from African maps that if you sailed east, you would, sailed west, you would get to the east, because it was a sphere. The planet was a sphere rather than some pancake. Okay, that's what all that was about. Well, based on his experience as a slave trader, and based upon the position that he held, and based upon the imperatives that were assigned him by the crown to generate a profit, so how are you going to generate profit? Well, we're going to create the system in which the Hidalgos establish agricultural domains to bring products back on the cheap to Europe and make the money that way. And they did it, of course, as things are still done, under a Christian religious seal. The system that was implemented was called encomiendo, that is, to commend. And one Hidalgo would commend to another Hidalgo a group of Indians, a village of Indians, say, as being worthy of salvation. And in that commendation, he had just licensed the other Hidalgo. This was reciprocal. They would do it for each other, make these commendations to one another in accordance with canon law of the church at the time. The way that you would save the Indians was teach them the Christian benefit of work, which means basically you had a license to enslave them, which is what they did. And so you had this vast impressment of slave labor to open areas that had been used for agricultural purposes by the Tiano population on Española for the growing of foodstuffs and so forth, to grow sugar, to grow other products that were luxury consumer items in a way, still for a high price in Spain.
If you fast forward to today, from the time of Columbus, the lives of indigenous people in this country have changed dramatically isn't even an adequate word, but there is also movements that have happened, particularly in the last half century, of indigenous people fighting for their rights. There's activities that are now exposing Christopher Columbus, and I think that in Denver, the Columbus Day activities have been well publicized. There's struggles around athletic teams using indigenous people as their mascots.
Yeah.
What goes on in Denver on Columbus Day?
Well, the celebration of Columbus Day, and actually the holiday of Columbus Day, originated in Denver. This is the 100th anniversary, the period just before the quincentennial celebration of the Columbian landfall, which occurred in 1992. 30 years leading up to that, you had all of this sort of coordinated activity to have a grand hoopla national celebration of it. And they had had Columbus Day parades in Colorado for a number of years after they initiated it back in 1907, but it had lapsed, and there hadn't been one for a considerable period of time. Well, they decided, the Sons of Italy in particularly, but it was something called the Federation of Italian American Organizations, decided that this was a compliment to Italians or Italian Americans, that he was a great hero of their history, and therefore we're going to reinstitute the holding of the annual parades in a process leading up to a real extravaganza that will occur in 1992. Well, we started out to protest that based on the historical realities that I was talking about, saying, you know, this guy symbolizes the inauguration of a continuous process of genocide against American Indians ongoing to the present day. That is not a worthy cause for celebration. It's, in its way, analogous to the Germans deciding to have a national holiday and a real extravaganza to celebrate Heinrich Himmler, because they had comparable positions in the hierarchy. Himmler, of course, was the guy in charge of the SS who was the preeminent figure responsible for the Holocaust. And we're talking about a Holocaust. Yeah, it would be inappropriate, and everyone understands that, for the Germans to have such a celebration. It's no less inappropriate for Americans to be doing that. You need to know your history, because it affects on us. It affects on our the sense of self-esteem and so on of our children in ways that lead to suicide rates and such as that, because the continuous tone of degradation that is culturally acceptable here has that effect on our children, but also a corresponding effect on everybody. If you're one of the celebrators, it makes you essentially a Nazi without even knowing it. Okay? So it's not good for anyone. How about we declare Italian American Day? We celebrate your culture if that's what you want to do. We got nothing against Italian Americans. We got nothing against Italian culture. Hell, I'll come down personally and cook pasta. But no, it's got to be Columbus. And so we had those confrontations that resulted in a cancellation of the parade. Thousands of people in the street in 2002. They basically ran up the white flag, literally, and sent a guy with a hanky tied to a stick over and asked him if they could leave peacefully if they just didn't hold the parade. We said, sure, why don't you just join us? They didn't hold it again for about 10 years after that, and then it was reconstituted. But the point is, there's a subterfuge that's involved. They're saying, you know, Italian Americans have been discriminated against historically, which is true, and there's cause for Italian Americans to celebrate their heritage and to have the nation join them in celebrating it to redeem that history of discrimination and so forth. Well, we're not opposed to that. What we're opposed to is turning Christopher Columbus, the symbol of genocide, into the symbol that is celebrated. Pick Marconi. Pick Joe DiMaggio. Help pick Annette Funicello. There's lots of worthy Italian Americans that you could choose from, or Italians for that matter. Why are you picking him?
Professor Churchill, I wanted to, this is Randall Callinan again. I grew up on the Leech Lake Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I became a civil rights lawyer is because I simultaneously grew up watching the civil rights movement on television. This is an extremely rural place, so there was really no place to go about that. But I also had several acquaintances of mine who were Native American, so I knew that discrimination existed against the Native Americans. So that combination of the civil rights movement and living amongst Native Americans caused me to want to become a civil rights lawyer. The question I have for you is, today on the over 200 Indian reservations, what are some of the most pressing issues facing the reservations today?
Poverty would be a huge, in fact, central. You got the poorest aggregate population group in North America. Overall, even with the casinos factored in and so forth, American Indians are still, as a population aggregate, recognized in the census, the single poorest group. It's not to say there aren't sectors of other population groups equally impoverished. Migrant workers, for example, probably in the same general vicinity, but that's only a subset of the overall Hispanic population, as they call it, okay? Although inner city, people in the barrios tend to share many of the same income characteristics and unemployment characteristics and so forth. It's still a part of the group. Inner city blacks and rural blacks in whole areas of the South are probably equally impoverished, close enough that it really doesn't matter, and why quibble? Okay, but that's a sector of the black population. The Indians, we're talking the whole thing. So poverty remains real high. And with poverty come things like endemic disease, truncated life expectancy. When you get to the way Indians are depicted, you know, there's a victim blaming game. They're totally dispossessed, Indian people as a whole, okay, constrained to fractions of land base with a trust authority asserted over their resources. Okay, and then held accountable as if they'd done this to themselves. Indians are lazy. Indians are habitual drunks. Indians are freeloaders. Indians are, and they're also jokes, tumbleweeds, cartoons. You got, I think, 1,400 odd place names inside the United States that include the word squaw, which is basically a corruption of a Mohawk word for female genitalia. You want to take that in slang and turn it into English, you know what the word would be, and it's four letters long. American Indian women, from children age 6 to grandmothers 86, are continuously referred to that and have to see it on maps, and complaints don't change it. You got Hiawatha pencils, Big Chief writing tablets, Jeep Cherokee vehicles, Washington Redskins football team, Cleveland Indians with their mascot, you got Teepee Motel, you got a continuous tone of demeanment and degradation, repetitive trauma, and so on, that results in literal suicide at about, oh, I don't know, something on the order of 500% the national average among adult men, as much as 1,400% among adolescents, and so on and so on and so on. You have this whole complex of immiseration that has been imposed in order to create the foundation upon which the United States and its economy have consolidated itself, with the general population of the United States taking as its due to live a quality of life which corresponds directly to the impoverishment of American Indians, the dispossession and disenfranchisement of American Indians, and so forth. Incidentally, it is not a venue lending itself to interpretation through the rubric of civil rights, because civil rights apply to the constituency, the population, and polity of a given country, the United States in this particular case. Indians are treaty peoples, by and large. There's 400-odd ratified treaties. Treaties are ratified, entered into by the United States only with other countries, okay? So you got a set of rights that attend nationality. Indians exist essentially in that sense as internal colonies. They're entitled to decolonization, self-governance, and sovereignty in the most clinical legal terms.
Now, Professor Churchill, this is Carl Cooper from Noticiero en Español. Going back to the original question about the freedom of speech and obviously all the repercussion that you have had to face based given the essay that you have published and obviously your constant struggle with the University of Colorado.
Constant trouble with University of Colorado now, because I'm not part of the University of Colorado now.
Correct. Now, the situation where we're seeing more, obviously, the possibility of going into war, or at least the government wanting to change its tactics to probably wanting to start a war with Iran, and obviously, as we all know, constantly observing the situation in Cuba. With those situations coming up or being discussed now ahead, for those people that are in disagreements and more likely will find themselves being ridiculed and target, what do you suggest they'll do, and how do you see this this system moving towards these speculations?
Well, you know, I had trouble hearing parts of that, but the pieces that I got, and if I missed something, fill me back in. Yeah, you got a lot of saber-rattling going on with regard to Iran right now, but you don't have a capacity on the part of the United States to actually engage in a war with Iran. You got a capacity on the part of the United States using high-tech weaponry to inflict incredible damage on Iran. They can kill a lot of people, but you can't actually, they don't have the capacity in terms of what they call boots on the ground to actually invade. Iran is a huge country. It's got 65 million people. They can't even secure Baghdad at this point. So it would be catastrophically stupid on their part to attempt to extend the war into Iran. I know that in geopolitical terms, they have a strategic vision of controlling all of that area of the world from Syria into northern Pakistan, but they don't have the capacity, without implementing a draft with all of the insurgency problems that would entail at home, to do that. They thought they could. They overrated the ability of technology to overcome the power of the people on the ground using essentially rudimentary or primitive weaponry to offset them. But ultimately, once you have opened up an area, you have to be able to occupy and hold it. And this is what they can't do. It ultimately comes down to individuals with rifles or whatever the corresponding low-grade technology would be at this point to be able to secure it. And they can't. Maybe they're actually crazy enough, and that would be the word, to attempt to do that and begin to conscript people to fulfill the need for maneuver battalions, occupation forces, and so forth. But then you're going to have a repetition of the sort of internal disintegration process that occurred during the Vietnam era. So they're between a rock and a hard place. And I frankly have to admit that I enjoy seeing them between the rock and the hard place, that the hubris has taken them into an untenable position, and you need to unpack, dismantle, if you will, this system if you're going to actually have the kind of fundamental change that's necessary.
Going back to your lawsuit, how far do you want to take it, and what do other people who share your same beliefs or who want to express their discontent with the current administration should do, not only to make their voice heard, but at least make sure that everybody else understands their point of view instead of being ridiculed?
You're not going to have a situation where everybody understands your point of view in the sense that they're going to agree with you. You have to understand that, you know, it's not an abstraction you're up against. It's people who have vested interests, and I'm not just talking about the so-called elites. You have a structure of people, a structure that's composed of people who, one way or ten ways, see their own interests as being in alignment with what it is that the United States, as a matter of policy, is doing in the world. They see themselves as benefiting from it, and you're not going to persuade them to take another point of view, by and large. They're going to continue to do what they're doing as long as they can. So that's the crunch point where you actually have confrontation. It's not a matter of worrying about whether you alienate conservative Christians in Colorado Springs or not. They're alienated. They're pathologically alienated. They are something you have to overcome. And you're probably going to have to overcome them on the terms they themselves impose. I'm using theocons is a kind of a symbol of a greater whole here, but I think you get the drift. And the terms they're imposing are clearly either direct infliction of violence or the threat of that infliction. How do you counter that? Dot, dot, dot. Use your imagination and figure out when you got somebody who is pathological and prepared to be lethal. In fact, is lethal on a day-to-day basis, whether you're talking about domestic policing or the not-so-benign form of neglect you see in a Ninth Ward in New Orleans, or the kinds of carnage you see in Iraq, or the saber rattling with regard to Iran, or with the maintenance of surrogate or client states out there who do the same kinds of things that are being done in Iraq as a matter of course, and I'm pointing at Israel as being a prime example of that, but it's hardly alone. When you got people who are willing to do this in order to maintain their own position of privilege and imagined prestige and so forth, they do it by force of arms. What are you going to use as the weapon of choice in the face of the fact they're imposing those terms on you?
If you look at what's going on in the civil rights arena in this country right now, on September 20th, anywhere from 50 to 100,000 people went to Gina, Louisiana to stand up for the Gina 6 and against racial injustice and systemic injustice against African Americans. What words, a large, large number of these people who were in Gina were from colleges and universities, particularly the historic black colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. What words do you have for college students today who are just beginning to get involved in things and did not experience the things that some of us did in the 60s and 70s?
Well, it's all waiting there to be experienced again, but in a new way because the system has continued to evolve and we have the lessons that we learned in the 60s to draw from, and then we're going to have to make a response that corresponds to both of those realities. And Gina was good because what was happening there, well, it speaks for itself. But why didn't you all get in your damn buses and drive on down to New Orleans where you got not a town of 3,000, but a whole city with a huge black community that's being, it's not threatened with, and you don't have six people drawn out of it unfairly to be dealt with as the Gen of Six were being dealt with, but you got a whole community in the Ninth Ward who's been utterly devastated, who's scattered across the country, and there's no desire, no intent, no plan to reconstitute it, to give them a chance to reassemble themselves as a community. Rather, there is a plan to convert where they lived into basically a yuppie recreational paradise.
I wanted to just end it by asking you, what are your plans for October 12th this year?
Well, on October 12th this year, I'll be in Denver, but they're actually, they sucker punched me in a way because they set the parade for October 6th, and I had already committed to be in Virginia to do a thing that conjoined both Columbus Day and Williamstown, which is basically Jamestown, the first Anglophone colony in North America. So I'm going to be engaged in activities, apparently, in Virginia at the time that the activities occur in Denver. There will be a response in Denver, but very reason I just indicated, I'm not going to be here. In a way, one protest, one confrontation is the same as another, same issue, different area of the country. Maybe we need heightened confrontation in other areas of the country besides Denver.
I agree. And on behalf of the volunteers and staff at KPFT, the Pacifica Station in Houston, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and talking about your experiences, and we wish you the best of luck in your political and legal maneuvers to follow.
Thank
you.
Continuing now with our top story, the controversy over anti-American Professor Ward Churchill. As we mentioned, Governor Owens of Colorado wants him fired from the university and the Board of Regents there.
It's been said that I've justified and advocated what happened on 911. I consider it an inevitability. You do not justify an inevitability.
Colorado wants him fired from the university and the Board of
Utterly misrepresenting what it was I was engaged in. Bush, at least in symbolic terms, is the world's leading terrorist.
Now we've invited Churchill on the fact. He says these things.
He absolutely thumbs his nose at the rule of law. He's the head of a rogue state by definition.
The problem with this guy is that he sees the USA as a country that persecutes people.
And it's a rogue state that persecutes people, dispenses carnage.
Bad, I just heard him say it.
On people presumed to be inferior.
He sees the USA as a racist country.
In some set of terms, whether they be racial or national or religious or otherwise, on the one hand,
Churchill's view is beyond extreme, but there is sympathy for him.
And of no particular utility to the empire on the other.
So, of course, any attack on America is justified in his mind.
Try to have a little empathy and respect for other people, and that would carry a long way. Just in and of itself.
He wants us to empathize with Al-Qaeda.
Towards alleviating the dynamic that produces 911.
Yet he has little empathy for his fellow countrymen who died on the
undoubtedly and inevitably will produce another one.
Did this surprise you that Ward Churchill was found to have committed these offenses?
Sort of taking my best shot at saying, hey, stop, think about this.
Not in the least. The big story around Churchill is that he is the tip of a very large iceberg. I've put 100 professors in my book, The Professors, but I could have put 10,000 of them.
And I'm paying the price of that, you see. There is this delighted political opportunism that goes into shooting the messenger here.
When you have a case like this, it exposes a widespread intellectual corruption of the university, which is what my book, The Professor, is about.
You have been listening to Killing the Indian to Save the Man, The Firing of Ward Churchill, a Pacifica Special Report.
Special thanks to Stacy Davis, Gloria Ruback, Carla Cooper, Randall Callinan, and Edwin Mercado.
And Scooter.
With music by John Trudell.